This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Poetry Foundation, with a reminder that Chicago is the pulse of poetry. Visit the Poetry Foundation on the corner of Superior and Dearborn to explore their library of 40,000 books, attend public events, and view Frente a la Vida, Facing Life, a striking multidisciplinary art exhibition by Chicago artist Victoria Martinez. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is WBEZ's Weekly News Recap. Well, folks, we made it to the end of another week. And since you're listening to this, you know that it's time to take a step back from the headlines and dig a little deeper on everything that happened in and around Chicago. Familiar carnage plagued the holiday weekend.
Chicago just experienced its most violent Memorial Day weekend on record.
Migrants in Chicago will receive aid from the city.
The Chicago City Council just voted to approve $51 million to fund migrant housing.
And Springfield was busy as it closed its session.
Illinois could soon see changes, 565 of them to be precise. That's how many bills state lawmakers passed in the spring session.
Here to break down those stories and more is A.D. Quick, Chicago Tribune, Cook County, and Chicago government reporter. Brandon Pope, reporter and anchor at CW26 and host of WBEZ's Making Podcast. And with us for the first time on the recap is WBEZ city government and politics reporter Tessa Weinberg. Let's begin with the city council, where there was some spirited debate, to put it mildly, this week. Tessa, can you first break down the $51 million in funding to house migrants? What exactly is it going to be used for?
Yeah, that $51 million is, you know, broadly going to be used to continue to support the thousands of asylum seekers that are here in Chicago, like staffing and running these shelters, you know, legal aid, transportation. We haven't seen a lot of specifics of breakdown of what that will look like, but that's kind of the broad brushstrokes. You know, earlier this week, there was over 4,000 asylum seekers and nearly a dozen shelters and temporary respite centers across the city.
Yeah.
And, you know, over 600, you know, sleeping in police station lobby floors. And so
this money is only going to be for a month.
Right. Yeah. Mm. That was something that the Lightfoot administration previously said. It's only going to last through June. And so I think that'll be something we'll be looking towards of when the city might need to be asking city council for more of these kind of surplus funds again, or if they'll need to.
As I mentioned, it was super tense at that meeting earlier this week. Here's a little bit of what Southside 20th Ward Alderwoman Jeanette Taylor had to say.
As Black people who have been hurt continuously by the city and country it loves, it ain't our responsibility to take care of everybody else.
Here's a little bit more of what she had to say.
I know it's right to want to help other people, because as Black people, that's what we do. But when the hell are y'all going to help us?
So though Taylor said that she was conflicted, the alderwoman ultimately voted in favor of the funding. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she ultimately voted in favor. She had, you know, said basically that hurt people don't hurt people. You know, her ward includes the former Wadsworth Elementary School that is being used as a temporary shelter for asylum seekers. And she's been very vocal and outspoken, you know, before even this meeting about, you know, what she feels was a lack of communication from former Mary Lori Lightfoot's administration about, mm-hmm. you know, choosing this shelter, putting in her community. She was saying how, you know, her ward doesn't have things like a bowling alley or a theater, but that, you know, the Black community can still support, you know, these incoming, you know, arrivals. And, you know, even as she voted yes for it, people were from the crowd were yelling out that she was a traitor. And so it was a very heated, you know, emotional, tense meeting.
And it was especially kind of personal for Taylor, too, because she was an original hunger striker trying mm-hmm. to keep Chicago Public Schools locations open, and seeing a vacant school essentially repurposed for something like this.
Yeah.
When she has been calling for investment for so long, I think was especially kind of acute for her.
Yeah. Mm. Chicago 675, one of our friends on YouTube, says black people in Chicago are last in every economic measure. It's a tough pill to swallow for the Black community.
Yeah.
Another alderwoman, Maria Haddon of the 49th Ward, representing Rogers Park. Here's a little bit of what she had to say.
Why are Black people in Chicago and some communities so angry?
Why is all this kind of anti-immigrant sentiment coming up? And I want to explain to folks, it's because if we cared as much about black people and had over the decades as we do about everyone else, we wouldn't be here.
Quite a few black alderpersons felt this way, didn't they, Brandon?
Yeah, it's that complicated feeling you feel from being just a black person in America. You're used to seeing our issues not prioritized, right? And so what you saw in that city council meeting was just real pain, just a decades-long pain, especially from people that grew up here. And it was interesting seeing Alderwoman Haddon engage with some people there that were heckling her and kind of like opening that dialogue. She kind of regretted it, she said, a little bit. But she understands that this is just, there's no easy answer here. And it's a struggling thing for so many people to grapple with. $51 million. We as journalists and reporters, we understand how that money may have come about. Mm-hmm. But the everyday person thinks,
no idea.
Wow, where'd you get that number? We're begging for resources. And now you got $51 million. And it's not going to us. Like, we keep asking, and we're not getting it. It's like, if your mama...
Even the idea that it's going to run out in a month, that goes over a lot of people's
minds.
And
that's the thing. It's like when you ask your mom for McDonald's, a Happy Meal, right? And she keeps telling you, nah, nah, nah. But then she buys herself an iPad. You're like, well, wait a second. You said there was no money here. Yeah. So that's the frustration that's going on.
Yeah. Emotions ran high, as Brandon just said, among the public, specifically at the meeting. Some were even escorted out by police for being disruptive. Let's listen to a little bit of that, and we'll hear from you all on the back end.
We cannot continue to falsely pit communities against one another.
Here's another person at the meeting.
We don't want to have to recall anybody. We don't want to have to protest anybody, but we are not going to be ignored, Brandon.
And that's Brandon Johnson, not Brandon Pope.
We have to keep doing that.
In studio. AD, though, in all seriousness, it seems like despite the funding being approved, this is an issue we're not going to stop hearing about.
No, and especially because of what we've all just been talking about, the $51 million running out at the end of the month. There's a lot of need, obviously. And it's not just at the city. It's at Cook County, which is providing health care to a lot of these families at their Northwest Side Clinic and at their hospital for specialty care. So it's a lot of looking to the state for state funding, and the state in its budget, which we're going to talk about, gave less than both the city and county requested to continue funding these services. And then the state kind of looking at the feds and saying, hey, this is a national crisis. There should be national funds to help us deal with this.
Yeah.
So I think not only throughout the next few weeks as we continue to see respite centers opening, we're going to see debates at Daly College and other places where they're considering opening. Broadway Armory is another one. If more folks are sleeping on police station floors, if there are more problems with 311 helping folks find shelter, this is an ongoing crisis, and we still don't know what the demand at the border is going to be long term.
Right. Yeah. Jules on YouTube says, I live on the South Side. The city never gave me a dollar. And Chicago 675 chimes in again saying, being pro-black is not anti-immigrant. Brandon, you have a thought there?
Yeah, because that's the thing. What Alderwoman Taylor was saying, though, hurt people don't hurt people, mm-hmm. I think that's the right sentiment. Like, the pain is understandable. You can be pro-black, but you can still be supportive of others, right? And you can still understand
Absolutely.
That there's a mutual struggle going on. They did not ask to be here, and black people didn't have to be here either, right? But there's still a shared struggle there, so there's got to be some sort of unity. I know that frustrations are high, but I think you can be both pro-black and pro let's help these asylum seekers.
Absolutely. One alderman was saying that the migrants might be infecting police officers with tuberculosis. What's going on?
Yeah, misinformation does not help any of this. So Alderman Raymond Lopez, we know he's a very active participant on Twitter. He's the 15th Ward of Alderman. Unfortunately, he used it to spread misinformation. He's been a big critic of housing asylum seekers
voted
no on the funding. He asked if the influx of asylum seekers is before or after tuberculosis infecting officers. There's been no cases according to the Department of Health, of tuberculosis from police officers, from any asylum seekers. So no one has any idea where he's getting any of this. It's just pure dangerous speculation.
What's
at this
point?
To drive up sentiment against the anti-immigrant sentiment. It feels like, I don't know what the point would be aside from that.
Yeah, that would be my question.
It's ugly to see that. So yeah, that was the fur there. There's, once again, the Department of Health says there have been zero cases from police or asylum seekers.
Thanks for clearing that up.
Makes no sense.
So moving on, Tessa, from this migrant crisis, what else happened at City Council this week?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the other major things they did was making permanent an expanded outdoor dining program that had really become a fixture and lifeline for restaurants and bars during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And so now bars and restaurants, they can apply for annual permits to expand their sidewalk cafes. You know, three restaurants or bars can band together and petition to close a street off to have outdoor dining. And they can now tap, you know, curb lanes as well. And there's a process for that. And another big feature, I think, that won support for alderpersons of why they passed this was that it gives them a say and they get to give the recommendation mm-hmm. on whether these permits should be approved. And that was something former Mayor Lori Lightfoot had not included in her previous version of the ordinance. So This was definitely a big, you know, legislative win for Mayor Johnson, who had put this forward.
Will any of y'all be outdoor dining this summer?
Absolutely. Yeah. I love being like, ooh, I'm going to go dine al fresco. That's one of my favorite things to say.
Sounds fancy.
Keep the time. Rolling. I love it.
This is Reset. I'm Zasha Ann Simons, and you are tuned in to our weekly news recap, where we bring context and analysis to the biggest local and state stories of the week. Our panel includes WBEZ's Tessa Weinberg, Adi Quigg of the Chicago Tribune, and Brandon Pope with CW26. Remember that you can also watch us break down these stories on WBEZ's Facebook and YouTube pages, and you can check out the video live stream right now. It's on Reset's Facebook page as well. Memorial Day weekend, we got to talk about that. It was the most deadly in 8 years. As the city tried to tackle crime, the Chicago Police Department's reform chief, she abruptly resigned, Tessa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Tina Scahill, she was the department's executive director of constitutional policing and reform. And, you know, she was charged with, you know, implementing basically the consent decree within the department. And the Sun-Times had reported that she submitted her resignation earlier this week with plans to retire later this month. She, you know, cited retaliation and even pointed to the state's Whistleblower Act. But she didn't really specify the nature of that retaliation. Mm. That seems still somewhat unclear.
That's a pretty serious allegation.
Yeah, that is. You know, the one of the mayor's top, you know, aides had told the Sun-Times that the police department has opened up an internal investigation over that. So I'm sure, you know, we'll be hearing more. And she was with the department. She was a longtime veteran of it. But she'd only been in that position since August of last year. Her predecessor was abruptly fired after, you know, complaining about officers being moved to patrol when he had requested they get moved somewhere else to be able to comply with some of these, you know, consent decree and federal requirements. And, you know, prior to that, the former civilian commanding officer of the department's audit division had also left.
Chad Williams.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And in a letter to
Lightfoot. Didn't he also cite retaliation?
Yes. Right. Yeah. Citing retaliation, saying the department, you know, failed to even feign interest in pursuing reform in a meaningful manner. So while we don't know, you know, the specifics around Scahill's resignation, it's mm-hmm. definitely been a, you know, revolving door of folks and, you know, especially when it comes to how the department is, you know, working to implement the consent decree and these reforms.
Wow. AD, Chicago's Civic Committee also realizes crime and reducing violence is the top priority for this city. The group revealed a public safety proposal this week. Can you walk us through that?
Right. So the Civic Committee is a roughly 150-year-old civic organization. The Commercial Club is old. The Civic Committee is relatively new, but they're behind a lot of Chicago's biggest tackling of issues. So the plan for Chicago in 1909, building of Stroger Hospital, this time they're tackling crime. It's something they haven't really tackled before. It's somewhat unclear what exact form this will take. It's kind of like a task force thing where you don't know how it will end up. But they said they'd be working on violence intervention, policing and criminal justice reforms, and hiring and investing in underinvested communities. Their goal is to make Chicago the safest big city in America, reduce homicides below 400 within 5 years, and bring shootings down to 2,000 within 5 years.
Hmm.
This, of course, was a huge deal in the mayoral campaign that we just got through.
Yeah.
We saw a lot of the business community lining up behind Paul Vallis, who campaigned on being tougher on crime mm-hmm. than Brandon Johnson. But Brandon Johnson, in his first weeks of the transition, pledged to work closely with the business community on a lot of issues. He had run on like an anti-tax or pro-tax platform that alienated some business leaders, but during the transition said, you know, I'm here. We got to work together, including on crime. So it'll be interesting to see how exactly they work together. There are some folks from the Civic Committee who are already on Johnson's transition. So figuring out how they're going to work together and what new hiring plans might be in place for a lot of these big corporations is going to be a big deal, because that's part of the long-term solution here. A lot of the neighborhoods with the highest violent crime rates also have the highest unemployment. So if these businesses really tackle long-term goals like hiring people,
yeah,
and workforce development, that can make a long-term difference. I'm interested in what the short-term solutions are here, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I mean, they tried doing this under Rahm Emanuel, something like this 10 years ago, where he wanted, like, I think a $50 million buy-in from the business mm-hmm. community. Ultimately, I think he raised most of that money, but it didn't result in any major dips in crime. So I'm wondering what that task force is going to do, if their approach is going to be more, you know, full-pronged, if there's going to be more hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
Hearing they want to actually invest in communities and get in the dirt there, that's kind of right in lockstep with what Brandon Johnson was running on. So it's going to be fascinating to watch that kind of intersection happen there. It's the first time they're doing this in 146 years of their existence. So
I hope it works.
It's going to be fascinating. Yeah.
Other news this week, Brandon, we know now a little bit more about what former Mayor Lori Lightfoot is going to be doing next. What's her new gig?
From Mayor Lightfoot to Professor Lightfoot, right?
Yeah.
So she's going to be teaching a course at Harvard School of Public Health. It's titled Health Policy and Leadership.
Okay.
It's going to be about how she steered Chicago through the COVID pandemic and some other parts of leadership. It's not
how
new.
She told everybody to stay home.
That's a big part of it. Taking basketballs from kids. You know, I'm sure there's going to be a section.
That's on the first
there.
Day.
You know, how to make a good meme. I'm sure that's part of it as well. Maybe a few quizzes on that. It starts in August. It's part of just saying. That was part of the COVID response, right? It starts in August. It's a part of a fellowship that other mayors have been a part of. Bill de Blasio, former New York mayor, he was also a Harvard fellow who did a 8-week course on leadership, depending on how you feel about his leadership style. But it's fascinating. So that's her next act for now.
Mm-hmm.
It's only 8 weeks, though. So we're going to see what happens next. But she's going to have office hours. She's going to be on campus. She's going to meet with students and all that type
wearing
of stuff.
Wearing a lot of tweed.
Wearing a lot of tweed, maybe some more tailored suits. We'll see what happens.
Yeah,
and she said she wants, you know, the public health commissioner Arwady to come speak to her students.
I was wondering about that.
Dynamic duo.
Yeah.
Hopefully in costume. Remember the Halloween
Rona,
costume?
The Rona Destroyer costume. Yeah.
Back now with more of the week's news. Lawmakers had to work into the wee hours of the morning over Memorial Day weekend, but they did eventually pass a $50.6 billion state budget. AD, are there a few things that stood out to you?
Well, for one, anyone who thought having supermajorities would make everything super easy, there's supermajority Democrats in both chambers in Springfield, you would think it would be like smooth sailing on everything. Not so. So we thought we had a deal on Wednesday. That was not the case. As you mentioned, they pulled this off of the weekend, like 3 a.m. on Saturday. This is like a transitional time for Springfield. We are post Madigan. We are post Greg Harris, the budgeteer who kind of like kept things running smoothly during budget season. A challenge for Speaker Welch to kind of get his ducks in a row within the various Democratic caucuses, because we have moderate Democrats. We have progressive Democrats. So what stood out? Continuation of the state-funded health care program for non-citizens who don't qualify yet for traditional federal Medicaid. They allocated about $550 million to that program. Folks might remember a few weeks ago it was projected to cost more than $1 billion. Like it grew much faster than legislators thought. So they addressed that to some extent, gave the governor some power to control costs there. This is separate from the fight for funding for healthcare for asylum seekers, by the way. This is folks who have been in the country for at least 5 years. Asylum seekers do not qualify for this program.
Okay.
Lawmakers also gave themselves raises from $85,000 to $89,675. And this is after they already gave themselves raises in January.
Lovely.
A 17% pay increase back then. They also punted on the Invest in Kids scholarship program. This is essentially a $75 million tax credit for people to donate to a private school scholarship program. They could take this up during veto session, so this is like not the end of the road for investing kids. Republicans predictably said this was unbalanced, did not go far enough to provide tax relief. Folks remember last year there were a bunch of COVID-related tax breaks on gas, groceries, school supplies. Not so in this budget.
Mm. Republicans were critical. They said that they had very little input. Let's listen to a little bit of House Minority Leader Tony McCombie.
Regardless of our weekly meetings, Speaker Welch, you gave a false hope for a new day. The House Republicans were denied participation in many things, but most importantly, this year's budget process.
Brandon, that doesn't exactly sound like there's a new spirit of bipartisanship in Springfield, does it?
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, the honeymoon is still rocky at this point. They still have to figure out the kinks and everything. AD put it pretty well. You still got moderates, you still got progressives, and there's still some big divides happening there about what's happening. They punted on a lot of stuff. You know, they punted on the Bears decision with Arlington Heights. They punted on a decision to try to get more people of color into the marijuana industry, elected school board. So there's a lot of things that this body's going to have to take up that are really big decisions that they just kind of like kick down the road.
And that criticism of Republicans in the House was not quite as vehement in the Senate. Republicans gave some credit to Senate President Don Harmon for inviting them to the table more than was happening over at the House.
And as AD mentioned, Tessa, one of the more controversial elements, because I want to make sure we don't skate over this, you know, is this raise that lawmakers gave themselves, right? 5.5%, to be exact. Base pay for members of the General Assembly will now be nearly $90,000. I mean, Brandon, Tessa, wouldn't it be amazing to be able to
give yourself a raise?
Vote on your own salary?
Oh, you guys are giving me a raise, right, for being here?
Absolutely not.
Oh, dang it. All right, catch you later.
This is free 99.
Yeah, you know, a few of the Democrats, they had cited that salary increase as why they were voting against, you know, the budget and part of their reasoning. And, you know, like AD mentioned, it's going from $85,000 to $89,675 about. You know, proponents were saying it's a cost of living adjustment. But, you know, they had just given themselves, you know, a raise in January. And that was a nearly 17% increase. So,
yeah. Wow.
Got to factor inflation, too. The price of eggs is crazy. I'm sure. You know. Throw a few extra thousand
That's
in there.
What was top of mind.
I'm sure. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Lawmakers passed 565 bills in this session, AD. One of them will boost pension benefits for Cook County employees. Tell us about that.
This is something I've been following for 8 years now.
Oof. Oh, yeah. My dear.
Some folks might remember way back in 2015, a very heated debate at the county to raise the sales tax by a penny on the dollar with money going to pump up county pensions, which were slated to basically go dry in 2055. So Cook County, like a lot of other local pension funds, was only paying in a fraction of what was actually needed to pay out money to beneficiaries, thanks to a statutory multiplier that didn't really account for any of the true costs. So for years, the county was making supplemental payments from that sales tax revenue to its pension fund. And technically, this is not kosher in state statute. Technically, you're only supposed to use property tax revenues to pay for county pensions. So they had like a handshake agreement between the county board and its pension fund to like keep making these extra payments. And for years, President Preckwinkle was trying to go down there and codify this. Because given Illinois' history of skipping pension payments, if she left office as board president, who was like dedicated to making these pension payments, or you get a bunch of Cook County commissioners who are like, wait, this is a ton of money. We'd rather be using this for regular services rather than kicking this over to pensions. Like, you got to get this in the code for it to keep going long into the future to finally fund pensions.
Yeah.
So she's gone down to Springfield multiple times to try to get this change, but kept hitting roadblocks, in part because she wanted to change the makeup of the pension fund board to give herself more appointees to it.
Oh, I see.
So the reason, a large part of the reason this passed this time is because she dropped that demand. This bill also has Tier 2 reforms to it.
What does that mean?
So Tier 2 were, it was like a pension fix to help make things more affordable, passed back in 2011. But the catch was that there wasn't enough money set aside to ensure that those retirees' benefits would match what folks make in Social Security. So this fixes that. And it doesn't cost them very much money. It's going to cost like $3 million a year, which in pension funding is like chump change.
Man, so I see why you've been following this for 8 years. It's a lot.
I can hear her talk about this all day. I'm fascinated.
So that's a big deal for the county. Not terribly expensive. What it is going to be a big deal for is city pensions when they make Tier 2 reforms.
Now we're talking.
We will get to this debate. This is something Mayor Brandon Johnson announced last week. We're going to do a pension reform task force. We're going to get together with our public safety pensioners at police and fire and figure this out.
Yeah.
And part of figuring that out is going to be, where the heck do we get this money? Brandon Johnson has been very opposed to raising property taxes, and property taxes is mainly how we fund pensions. So
interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Brandon Johnson here is the legislation was proposed by Democratic State Senator Robert Martwick of Chicago, Tessa. He's also sponsoring other pension legislation, but this one stalled, right? What's going on?
Right, yeah. So Martwick had some bills that were going to increase firefighter pension benefits, specifically for Tier 2, like AD had talked about.
Yeah.
And he said he got a call from Mayor Johnson, who asked Martwick to, you know, press pause, allow Johnson's administration to kind of, you know, wrap their head around the situation, make their own assessments, you know, give them chance to kind of put forward their plans. And, you know, Martwick agreed. You know, he said he anticipates being part of that working group that Johnson announced. And Johnson says he's had good discussions with police and fire unions. And it seems like the goal so far is to come up with some kind of proposal or solution by the time lawmakers convene for their veto session in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Whether these bills will be part of it, I think, remains to be seen. You know, former Mayor Lori Lightfoot's administration had testified against them, saying it was going to, you know, raise the unfunded liability by $3 billion. The Civic Federation had also urged caution. But Johnson's first deputy chief of staff, you know, was a co-sponsor in these bills. So, it, you know, it's an interesting landscape. And I think, you know, we'll definitely be watching for what kinds of solutions they come forward with.
It's also going to be interesting to see how Johnson works with John Catanzara of the FOP. He mm-hmm. said that they had a discussion already about how they're going to kind of piece this thing together. So we know that Catanzara has been very contentious toward past mayors, even during the
campaign.
Brandon Johnson,
yeah.
For
sure.
He said
there would be blood in the streets.
Blood in the streets if he's elected. We got to see how they work together
and
to get this done.
All the officers were going to resign.
Yeah, that didn't happen.
Has it happened yet?
No surprise, okay. Right?
This is Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. You're tuned into our weekly news recap, where we bring context and analysis to the biggest local and state stories of the week. Our panel today, Brandon Pope with CW26, the Chicago Tribune's A.D. Quigg, and WBEZ's Tessa Weinberg. And our friends are still watching us on Facebook and YouTube right now. A.D., minimum wage in the county, it's about to increase, but I'm not sure that workers are going to be celebrating when they read that fine print.
Yeah, they're like, what about the eggs? I'm not able to afford these eggs.
Can't make an omelet no more.
The county issued notice Tuesday that its minimum wage for non-tipped employees working in the county would rise from $13.35 to $13.70 on July 1st. Tipped employees' minimum wage will go up from $7.40 to $8 an hour. This is tied to inflation, but not as high as inflation has actually gone. It is capped at 2.5%, while the consumer price index went up 4.9%. So the buying power of that raise doesn't really do the trick. This applies to anywhere in Cook County that isn't Chicago or a municipality that has its own minimum wage requirements. So check the paperwork. But at the end of the day, it's rising but not keeping up with inflation.
Well, Cook County government workers might be excited to hear the news about paid parental leave, though.
Yes.
What are those details?
This has been talked about for a few months. Commissioner Bridget Degnan and Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle basically said, we want to increase paid leave across the board for county employees to 12 weeks. So current policy allows for 4 weeks paid leave for birthing parent that has a non-surgical delivery, 6 weeks for a surgical delivery. So if you have a C-section, 6 weeks. Non-birthing parents and adoptive parents were only entitled to 2 weeks. So if you were, I remember talking to a lot of dads, young dads.
That's not a lot of time at all.
Who would only get 2 weeks. And oftentimes they were balancing it or trying to work it out with their spouse so that their spouse, they could cover as much ground as possible.
Yeah.
So citing research around improved health outcomes for kids, for parents, they approved a resolution to study how much this would cost a few weeks ago. So we got the numbers. Only $3.8 million.
Oh, that's it?
Oh, wow.
Only $3.8 million.
That's doable.
So that will cover the additional salary for when folks are not working and also overtime for folks that are covering for the people that are gone. And it's going to be for all parents, adoptive, foster, birthing, non-birthing.
Yeah. Much more comprehensive.
It still has to pass through like the full board, but
yeah,
everyone was supportive when this first came out. And I think now that we have the cost and the cost is relatively modest,
yeah,
it's probably going to clear the whole board.
Brandon, let's switch gears here. Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul had harsh words for Cardinal Blaise Cupich. This is a week after releasing his stunning investigation of how nearly 2,000 Illinois kids were abused by clergy. So what did Kwame Raoul say?
Yeah, ground-shaking report. It said 451 different clergy members had been engaging in misconduct since 1950. That's more than the church had counted at 103, significantly more.
Yeah.
Little back and forth happens. Blaise Cupich says, hey, I would have liked to have gotten a heads up on this. He says that he felt like he had this relationship with the AG where they could discuss this first and that he would like to have, you know, notice of the new names and new accusations so he could investigate it himself. He also wants more clarity on how the AG came to these conclusions. And so Kwame Raoul says, I'll just read what he said here because it's quite eye-popping. He said, at best, Blaise Subic's comments are misleading. At worst, it's more of the same, a continuation of the church's decades-long pattern of turning a blind eye. He says the two are going to talk when Subic returns from the Vatican. But tough talk there from Kwame Raoul. He's not backing down on this. He's kind of, I'm sure he's thinking, why would I give you a heads up? This is bigger than a heads up. This is like gross misconduct.
A lot of these names came directly from your list.
That right. too, exactly. So it's just gross misconduct, and it's a dark stain on the clergy here in Illinois throughout the entire state, not just here in Chicago.
Meanwhile, advocates for victims of clergy abuse rallied outside the Joliet Diocese this week on Wednesday. What was that about?
Yeah, there's a group called SNAP, the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. They say that the Joliet Catholic Church list of abusers is not complete, and they believe there's a lack of transparency going on. They have a list on their website. The AG report listed 69 credibly accused priests, but the Joliet Diocese website, they say that it's missing 8 different names, and they say there could be more that are not even included here.
Wow.
So they think there should be more. They want more transparency, and so that's what they're calling for. That's why they're protesting. Obviously, emotions super high because this is just ugly, ugly stuff. And the fact that for so long the Catholic Church has been just burying these things and burying these things, and now you got 8 possible names and even more that could just be omitted.
One of our friends on YouTube, Shamrock Bloom, says another in a series of dark stains on the Catholic Church.
Yeah. Well,
this was the report itself was remarkable to read. Like often we get a press release and maybe like a copy of a lawsuit. This was like an entire website, including with narratives of survivor narratives detailing exactly what happened, which is very difficult to read, but very important to read if you can stomach it, to kind of bear witness to what was covered up for so long.
Yeah.
And these things don't happen in a vacuum. It's systemic.
They don't.
You know, that's the thing. Like, so many people have to turn a blind eye and just say, this is okay, or we're going to let this happen, for it to continue to happen for so long.
Yeah.
It's disgusting. It's wrong. And we're going to see what more names may pop up.
Back now with more from the weekly news recap. Here's a suburban story getting attention. It has to do with how DuPage County gets its water. AD, you covered this, right?
Yes. They get it from the city of Chicago, right next door to where we are here at Navy Pier.
Ah.
Okay, hand gestures.
Yeah, you guys on YouTube get to see my wonderful hand gestures. I'm gesturing to the Jardine Water Treatment Plant
right
next
here.
Door. So DuPage has been a customer for the city of Chicago for 40 years, but their contract is expiring. By September, they basically have to tell the city whether they want to continue buying water from them or not. Folks might remember a few weeks ago, the city reached a water deal with the city of Joliet to deliver water starting in 2030 for the foreseeable future. It's a long-term contract. It's really good for the city's finances. And DuPage looked at that contract and said, we would like those terms, please. And if you, as part of our due diligence, it's the first time this contract is coming up in 40 years, we need to look at all of our options.
Mm.
And one of the options that they are looking at is potentially building their own pipes all the way from Lake Michigan out to Elmhurst, instead of buying it from the city of Chicago. This would cost billions of dollars, would be very complicated.
Would take time.
Would take a long time. But they say long term, this could be more affordable than the current rates that the city of Chicago is charging. The city came back and said, we love you guys. Please stick around. We plan on giving you the same kind of rates that we're giving Joliet. So right now, everyone in that buys water from Chicago is paying the same rate. So it's $4.54 per 1,000 gallons. In the Joliet contract, they're switching it around a little bit. They're moving to a cost of service model that basically says you're going to pay different rates based on how hard it is to get the water to you, what kind of infrastructure you're using to receive the water. DuPage has a really straightforward way of getting water. It's like a couple of pumping stations, huge pipes so they can deliver a lot of water. It's more costly if you got to go down smaller pipes to grandma's like half-inch meter.
So this, do you think that this is in any way realistic for DuPage or
to
maybe
build,
a
to build their own?
Yeah, or maybe just a negotiating tactic.
It could be both.
Ooh.
And if it, the city has basically said, yes, we are going to give you this cost of service rate. It might just be a matter of how soon that cost of service rate kicks in. So for Joliet, for everyone across the board, it is by 2030.
Yeah.
So 2030 at the latest. But Chicago is duty bound to charge everyone that's buying water from them the same rate.
The same rate.
And what Chicago officials told me was it's kind of complicated to calculate this rate for all of our customers. They have a lot of customers. They all have different infrastructure. They all have different use patterns. The DuPage thing was basically like unthinkable, like super complicated. But because of the way that they say the negotiations have gone, they haven't got like the full responsiveness from the city that they want. So they looked into this. And now they're like, it's possible. It's doable. But it would be
interesting,
a huge thing to tackle. And if they did it, it would also be a threat to Chicago from picking up more suburban customers.
Of course.
Because
yeah.
as folks are probably aware, a lot of suburban customers still rely on groundwater, their aquifer. But a lot of those are drying up.
Yeah.
So this demand for lake water is, I think, only going to increase. Climate change is another factor here that is almost immeasurable, as are the rest of our, as I refer to them, lake sipping partners in Wisconsin, in Indiana, all over. There's like a lot of stuff.
A lot of moving parts.
A lot of things to consider.
Well, we are now in the month of June, Brandon, which means it is Pride Month. You've done some stories about some new LGBTQ events that are happening this year. So tell us about some of those.
Yeah, some great stuff. So big one, Elgin is having their first ever Pride Festival and Parade. They've never had one before.
Awesome.
I spoke with the lead organizer. Her name's Kayla Bates. She told me this was more than 5 years in the making. She feels the community, the business community especially, has been super supportive of them. And they rallied around the idea. So that's this Sunday, 11 a.m., downtown Elgin, the first one, so it's sure to be a good time. Family friendly, everyone's invited. But here in Chicago, back home, the Shedd Aquarium hosting the Queer Fam Pride Jam. It's a daytime family focused pride celebration on June 17th from like 10 a.m. till 4. They got all kinds of cool things that kids like to do, face and adults too. Face painting, dance parties.
Mm-hmm. Touch the stingrays.
Touching the stingrays. You could obviously see the fishies and the turtles. There's a drag dress-up and makeover. They got wellness activities. They got a vendor market for the adults who want to buy some candles and fancy boutique type of things.
Nice.
And it's all sponsored by our friends at Block Club Chicago. Oh, yes, indeed.
Ooh, yes.
Sure to be fun.
Well, Tessa, Chicago kids also have a reason to celebrate because school is letting out next week for summer and some parents like me are crying inside. But we know that one of Mayor Johnson's, one of his first executive orders, we've talked about this on the program, it was to boost youth employment, right? Clearly he wants to avoid what we saw back in April when we had a, you know, large gatherings of teens and chaos downtown. But increasing youth employment, I mean, it continues to be a challenge, right? I feel like it's easier said than done.
Yeah, definitely. You know, he said he wants to double the number of youth hired, and they're kind of building on the city's summer youth employment program that employs 14 to 24-year-olds and pairs them with employers. But he, you know, just took office recently. You know, I believe applications are set to, you know, originally close today.
Yeah.
They're closing soon. And he's kind of locked into that budget that Lightfoot had for the program. You know, last summer, over 20,000 teens were employed through it. But Johnson's, you know, his administration has said they were already talking with corporations, business partners, trying to get them to hire more youth, boost employment. And over, you know, Memorial Day weekend ahead of that, when Johnson was, you know, announcing some of his plans, he announced a bunch of grant funding for different organizations, you know, to reduce violence. And some of that included projects to engage teens. I think one of them was to hire young people to run a community garden.
Oh, cool.
So it seems like there's other avenues he's kind of tapping as well. I believe in the state budget, there was even, you know, $15 million regarding a youth summer program. I don't know how much of that will be coming to Chicago per se. But yeah, so we'll see. It seems like they're taking kind of a broad brush approach.
Yeah.
The key thing is finding stuff kids actually want to do. That's really the key. You can have the programming, but is it actually stuff that's cool?
I mean, my kids would do the community garden stuff.
Yeah.
They'd love that.
But maybe not every kid.
But with every kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You recently interviewed, Brandon, the head of After School Matters, which is, we know, a big source for teen summer jobs. What did Mary Ellen Karen say?
Oh, well, hey, they are hiring instructors for the summer. But the cool thing about After School Matters, too, is that the kids that participate in the program also get paid for participating in the program as well. So they can pocket a little bit of money. So applications are open. It's a program where you can have instructors from different industries teach a wide array of different things, from art to business. I taught with After School Matters, a journalism class, sports journalism in South Shore.
Cool.
Did a lot of kids show up?
A lot of kids showed up. Three
That's
summers.
Yay, That's mini really journalists. Cool.
It was a learning experience for sure, because while I wanted to just talk about journalism, a lot of times I had to deal with handling interpersonal conflicts and dealing with their own traumas and things like that.
That's like a real newsroom.
Like a very much like the journalism
like us
community.
Here, off
yes,
the air.
Absolutely.
No,
but it's something I encourage everyone, if you have some spare time, to get involved in.
Yeah.
It helped inform my perspective a little bit. So, you know, we all cover these communities, but when you're actually embedded in one, you're going to South Shore every day on 71st and Jeffrey, you're talking to kids about their reality, the places they go to, places they are afraid to go to. It's really informative and helps shape perspective and helps inform your reporting as well. So
it's a big difference.
It makes a big difference. Absolutely.
We misspoke earlier, listeners. I just want to make a quick correction. The Queer Femme Pride Jam is at the Salt Shed, not
Salt
Shed.
Salt Shed, my bad.
At the Salt Shed. And
no
the,
touching stingrays?
No touching stingrays.
No,
darn it.
No. And the Elgin Pride Parade is tomorrow, Saturday, June 3rd.
That is Saturday, right?
According to my notes/producers. Thank you. So it's been a hot week. We gotta talk about that. Temperatures hit 90 degrees this week. The city reminded landlords about Chicago's cooling ordinance. We will remember that was put in place last summer. This was after, unfortunately, three women died in a Rogers Park senior living complex. Buildings that run as housing for adults who are over 55 years old, and if they've got more than 100 units, they have to provide AC in all apartments, or they've got to have an air-conditioned common space whenever it's hotter than 80 degrees. Have y'all turned your AC on?
Oh, yeah.
Just
yes.
Definitely, yeah.
Have to.
Yeah, I woke up to a text. I woke up to a text from my daughter that she had sent. Poor thing, sent it at midnight. I was knocked out, of course. I mean, who does she think I am? I have to wake up for the weekly news recap. And it was like, can we turn on the AC? I'm sweating in here. And I was like, oh, poor child.
Wait, you haven't?
I hadn't yet.
Oh, wow.
It's on now.
Wait, you turned it on just last night?
Yes.
Oh
wow.
My God, that's hardcore.
Wow.
We were toughing it out.
I was like, AC on, blackout curtains, like, I need to get some blackout curtains.
There you go. That's the way to do it.
It's an investment,
that's
but it's
a
worthwhile.
Good idea.
Pays for itself.
Look, I be sweating. So I have no choice but to turn the AC on. No choice.
No, it took me a while. It just happened today. So yeah, don't shame me.
No, I'm
going to regret sharing that story.
I am intimidated.
No. I'm going to call CPS.
Well, there's a great way to cool off, which is going out on a boat. I mean, if you're not lucky enough to own or know someone who's got a boat, you can go out for a day on a charter boat. Now, the Coast Guard reminds us that charter boats need to be licensed and they need to be inspected. Someone who didn't get that message, though, is 36-year-old boat owner Mike Garbowski in Michigan. He was just sentenced to 1 year in federal prison for illegally chartering his boat.
Wow.
Any of you gone out on a charter boat?
Absolutely.
It's on my list for this summer.
Every summer.
Too. Yeah, I haven't yet.
I haven't yet.
Yeah.
It's a must. You're going to love it. Get your friends, get some food, get some drinks. It's going to be a good time.
I like
time.
Those little electric ones that you could take on the river.
Yeah.
BYO food.
Those
and
are
drinks.
Very fun.
Those are lovely. It's not like you're going to park it in the middle of the lake and jump out, but like, it's just nice being on the water.
Garbowski, sometimes what he did was he took his passengers to places like the Playpen, which is that crowded lakefront area at Oak Street Beach.
Yeah, I'm ready. Let's go.
The boats anchor there. They tie up to each other. You've been there?
Of course.
No.
Is it like Party Central?
It
I'm not
sure
cool
is.
Enough to go to the Playpen.
It
yeah.
is a lituation, as the kids say.
A lituation.
Yeah, and you like get on other people's boats and you know,
oh,
you,
wow.
you share the camaraderie.
Just make sure you're with somebody who knows what they're doing because there has been
boat
accidents.
Is properly chartered.
Yes, there have been accidents. At the playpen,
and boat
so safety
is very important.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
A quick warning to our listeners, if you're going downtown this weekend, there's a family of falcons. They've set up their nest on a Wacker Drive high-rise near Monroe. Apparently, the mama's been dive-bombing pedestrians, so be careful out there because she fears them harming her young. And
wow.
One person actually said that it felt like being hit with a 16-inch softball.
Ooh, wow. What a great Chicago reference.
Yeah, he ended up with a one-inch gash on his head.
Gosh. Oh, wow.
Did you ever have a close encounter with wildlife, AD? Or hear stories
I'm racking.
It?
I'm racking my brain.
Other than being pooped on.
Right. That has happened to me.
Yeah, it happened to me. Yeah.
I grew up in Indiana, so I had friends with farms. Nothing bad ever happened.
Nothing bad? No.
I had a cat scratch my face when I was sleeping.
Oh,
as
that's
a
nothing.
Child. It doesn't, huh? doesn't count?
No,
it
doesn't count. That's not wildlife.
It was wild to me.
But listen, if you're downtown this weekend, you might also have to watch out for crowds of Swifties. I got to mention this before we go.
It's also a bird, as a lot of people know. Swift is a bird as well. You can just bring it back.
I'm talking about the people who are going to Taylor Swift's sold-out Soldier Field concerts this weekend. Mm. I think the only Swiftie at the table is you, Brandon.
Moderately. I like the album. It was a fun little
Don't
album.
Don't backtrack.
It was a fun little album.
So if you had to go, what era would you dress up in?
Well, I don't think I would go. But if I had to...
If someone was like, I have an extra ticket, Brandon, come with, but you have to dress up,
probably
what would you wear?
Probably the first era where she was doing that stay country music era.
So like curly hair.
Yeah,
Taylor.
Like curly hair Taylor. That's probably
curly
the
hair
one.
Taylor.
Maxi dress, curly hair, acoustic
sure.
guitar Taylor.
But I'm also not familiar with all the different eras. I just, yeah. you know, but that I guess that'd be the one I would go with. I don't know how I'd dress for that. Cowboy hat?
Well,
you know?
Anybody sure. going, stay safe out there. We'll leave it there. That's it for the recap. My thanks to Chicago Tribune's A.D. Quigg, Brandon Pope of CW26, and WBEZ's Tessa Weinberg. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks.
This episode of Reset was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Andrew Merriweather and Meha Ahmed. Never miss the weekly news recap by subscribing to our podcast. And if you've got a fellow news junkie in your life, how about giving them the gift of Reset? Sharing our show supports our show. That'll do it for today. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Have a wonderful weekend.